You're listening to Raising Anchor, the Rhode Island FC podcast, now part of the Blazing Musket family. We're glad you're here. Hello, and welcome to the Raising Anchor podcast mailbag. This is your episode for February 2017, and we're answering your burning questions. So let's start things off right now. Jason, their name is Max, asks, is RIFC getting a promotion? This is, I think quite a few of these first questions are going to be in lieu of the news last week that USL dropped that they will be creating a Division One league, and it's quietly and very loudly assumed that Rhode Island FC will be joining that Division One league. So, is Rhode Island FC getting a promotion?
Potentially. I'm going to have to consult with the other managers here. We're going to have to kind of go through their quarterly review, make sure that they're hitting all their KPIs. But in all seriousness, I think that when we start to look at some of the decisions that were made around this club, you start to think that maybe there was always some sort of goal in mind that, hey, if some sort of lower top division were to ever be a thing, you know, they already had the idea in mind, expand that to 15,000 if that need be, if the option's available there, the metropolitan area in terms of population. I mean, we're kind of checking all those boxes as you start to look through that. So I think it is a very good possibility.
I mean, I complained that there wasn't an awning being built into the stadium, and they said at the time that was because if they wanted to expand the grandstands around the entire circumference of the stadium, that had to go in before they started building permanent, you know, let's call it weatherproofing. Well, now I'm kind of understanding why. So it looks like Tidewater almost completed, but will probably most likely continue to re-enter construction and get upgrades here in the new future. I'm going to ask you a second question here. Matt J writes in, with USL now creating this 12 to 14 league division, do you think RIFC would benefit from being a part of it? So the question here would we be as competitive maybe in a higher division?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we made the final in our first year. I mean, and as we, you know, get close to starting that second season, you look at the ambition of this club, like right off the bat, we go and sign Maxi Rodriguez from Detroit City. I mean, that is a huge acquisition that kind of puts the stamp on the league and says like, hey, no, this is a serious club. We're here for business. So if there is a premier league, whatever they want to call it, Division One, I think RFC needs to do everything they can to be a part of it.
All right.
And so what do we got here? Mike is asking, do you think USL has been sitting on this announcement for a while, waiting to see how the Nassau lawsuit panned out? And what impact, if any, do you think the lawsuit had?
So I'm not speaking from hearsay or like my guess. It was actually announced in one of the articles. I think it was The Athletic or The Guardian, that that's exactly what they did. They waited to see where the dust would settle in the U.S. soccer antitrust, understanding, you know, did Nassau have a claim? Was there some legitimacy, or was it all just frivolous and a waste of people's time? We obviously know now that Nassau did not get their way or what they were hoping to get out of the antitrust lawsuit. But what that means for the future, which is kind of the second part of that question there, is this still spotlighted what the requirements are for not just the PLS, but also how the U.S. soccer governs the application and acceptance of the different sanctions in divisional soccer. So whether it's Division 3, 2, or 1, it kind of brought everyone's attention very readily to what the current goalposts are. U.S. soccer has been accused in the past of, you know, oh, well, in 1996, you only had to have 8 teams. And now, you know, in 2025, you have to have 12 teams, right? It has changed over the eras, and it's changed with kind of the overall appetite of what soccer is in the country. U.S. soccer has an obligation to grow the sport, not live in, you know, not rest on its laurels. So having said that, what this does in the immediacy is it really puts a spotlight on the current requirements. It's kind of like when the U.S. Open Cup, when MLS pulled out of it, everyone was very aware suddenly of the participation, the fact that it was the oldest tournament in the history of the game when it comes to North American sports. So there was a lot of, you know, like, okay, here's what it is. Now with this happening at this moment in time, that's going to say, okay, these are the requirements. You can't really change. You can't shy away from them over the next couple of years. And since you've made your intent that you'll be starting this in 2027, those goalposts can't change. Like, you can't get to the end of 2026 and say, oh, you needed 20 teams, or these stadiums need to be like 20,000 people to be able to fit in. So it's a good move from the league. And, you know, it was exciting to hear that they've been sitting on it for a while. Basically, they had the confidence and the wherewithal that they wanted to do this earlier. My assumption is that they wanted to announce this right after USL Cup final. But again, they knew that this antitrust was coming, so they probably waited a little bit longer. And, you know, again, you get one chance to do these things right. And I think they absolutely did with this particular one.
Yeah. And just to really touch on that real quick before we move on here, like, you think about the whole lawsuit in terms of them trying to say that they were, you know, U.S. soccer and MLS were trying to not allow there to be any sort of opportunities, right? So with the, you know, the delegation there, these are what meet these KPIs, and then this is how you become Division One. At this point, they can now say, well, okay, you tried at USL, you didn't meet it, you didn't work. Like, we're not favoring anyone at this point because you just weren't able to meet the goals there.
You're not the New York Cosmos. Get over yourself. James writes in, wait, is this USL Championship not a Division One league? This is a real question, and I'm not insulting, sorry, not James, J-Max. And to be completely clear, he prefaced later, he just thought it was because it's the highest level of soccer, not an MLS. He didn't know that there was, that we were actually under the MLS there. So thoughts on, you know, I guess not just J-Max, obviously that's a yes or no, but like the overall awareness of fans that love this club that may not understand the soccer hierarchy.
Yeah, so there's different pyramids. Every country to a certain extent has the setup slightly similar.
Should I put this one on the screen so you can walk people through what the current one is in USL with this new expansion?
Yeah, sure. And so if we look at this current, like, projected expansion, at the top of Division One, you would have the USL Premier. Below that, you would have the Championship, where RAFC currently plays, which is a Division Two. Below that, you have USL League One, a third division, and then there's that fourth division, USL League Two.
They're not even fourth, though. They're like fifth.
Yeah,
MLS Next Pro technically, like, fits the gap between that.
Yeah, but they're part of the USL family, though, so they're fourth in my heart. Like,
gotta be Adam. You gotta add them, yeah.
Yeah, so essentially, there are certain kind of qualifications that you have to meet to be regarded as a Division One, and unfortunately, the reality is Championship does not meet those. Some of the teams do, and that's why when we look to this USL Premier coming up here, we only have a projected, you know, 14, maybe 16 teams who can kind of be eligible for that. They can apply for, you know, the opportunity to have extensions on that and say, hey, okay, here are my blueprints. I'm expanding my stadium. Give me a few more years and I'll have 15,000 in here. I've already got 11.
Okay, let's move on.
And then, so here we've got Jed Thorpe. And it says, so ... competing with MLS.
I mean, it's part statement and it's part question, right? And let's be honest, for everyone out there who loves, you know, the Revolution, for example, and RIFC, this isn't suddenly you fighting over your favorite child. You're still going to be able to love both teams, regardless of if Rhode Island FC goes to Division One or not. I don't see this as a competition. I think maybe at the end of the day, from eyeballs and like market share, maybe, but, you know, and we said this on the podcast, if you go and look at what USL is trying to accomplish, they built this from the ground up. Whereas at this point, MLS has really kind of built this from the top down, right? It's two different versions. Like, they had MLS, then they started an academy system. Now they've branched out into an MLS Next Pro. Whereas USL was like, hey, we know where we are and we're going to climb the ladder a little bit. Oh, now we're suddenly Division Three. Hey, we're going to get sanctioning to become Division Two, and now we're requesting Division One. So in a lot of ways, looking back at that pyramid, like, USL has built a better foundation. So I don't see this as a competition. And since the two won't meet and they won't mingle except for the Open Cup, for now, it's like you can have two favorites. If the two were to ever integrate, it'd be a major problem, because then it's like, well, how do I love two teams that are going to square off, you know, twice a year? But the reality also to it, MLS is moving in a completely different direction, right? They're focused on their broadcast package. They're focused on trying to become a European transfer window schedule to where they're going to be playing primarily in the fall and winter and wrapping up in the spring. We'll be starting in the spring and wrapping up in the fall. So these two ships are never really going to pass each other in the night. It's just going to give fans of the sport more to watch at a higher level of competition. And honestly, too, like a lot of people that maybe feel that, you know, MLS isn't as authentic, they may get this new product, this new differentiation. And then, of course, ProRail, right? So like they're not competing. They're two different entities. Think of it as like the MLS is the NFL and the USL is the rest of the regular soccer world.
Yeah, I think also to touch on the MLS, kind of their kind of end game here in a way, is it almost feels like they are moving away. I mean, they to a certain extent they have, maybe with the exception of Miami. Like they're not going out and buying old aging stars anymore, right? They're trying to look for these diamond in the rough kind of South American players who maybe just need the opportunity to play somewhere to get a little more visibility to then make that jump to a European team. So you see a lot of the teams, especially with the U22 initiatives and whatnot, you can sign DPs under a certain age, pay them whatever, and then not have that count against the salary cap. That way you can then get a few good years out of them and then boom, move them on to Europe somewhere, cash in, and then continue that flow. The reality is with the money that is in USL, we'll definitely have our Nick Markaniches, our Wideners and things like that, where we can kind of move players through, but we're not ever going to be at that caliber. The idea here is to become a more quote unquote authentic soccer league.
Well, I wouldn't say never, but it probably wouldn't happen in our lifetimes. Yeah. So, I mean, we've got the Noah Fusans that we can have and the Jackson Lees to sell on to MLS one day. But yeah, it is a different product that you'd be consuming. And the best part is at the end of the day, it grows the game across the country because MLS, 30 teams, right? Maybe they'll grow more. There's no real aspirations. USL, 25 teams right now. They'll get to 29. If they only take 12, well, that's room to grow another 24 markets in soccer. MLS has no interest in doing that anymore. They have their formula. They're going to rinse and repeat. So USL really becomes the wild frontier about growing the game. And that's just an exciting prospect to have. The Union Report writes in, love the idea of ProRail, which would set us apart from MLS, but at the same time, does it strengthen the USL as a whole or make it even more fragile?
I mean, I think it is important to think about that. And when we talk about this, the reality is ProRail is not going to happen day one, right? You're going to probably have maybe 5 years or so of a championship where you're trying to then also have the bottom kind of give them some time to kind of catch up to you, make sure that you have certain protections set in place. But there are traditional soccer fans who don't pay that much attention to MLS. They look at the weird salary cap rules, the nonsense when it comes to they don't actually play each other enough times. I know we're kind of struggling with that right now as we continue to expand. But if we're talking about a premiership with 14 teams, you know that everyone's going to get a chance to play each other. So you can count on there being true parity there. So you can really look at things like the Shield and say like, no, this is the best team during the regular season and really like give that trophy meaning. Not that it doesn't have meaning, but there's always that, you know, opportunity to say, well, you got to beat up on, you know, like even when we look at the East last year, everyone got free points from Miami, right?
So, but, I mean, but look what Miami's doing, right? Like they're not folding, they're reinvesting because they want to be a part of the next step of this journey, right? So to answer the question back to it, does this make us more fragile? I think it will weed out some weaker willed owners.
Oh, definitely.
But I don't know that the clubs will fold because now suddenly people are going to find a way to get invested into something where they could then promote up and become a part. Because again, remember, the divestiture in an MLS club now is at $500 million for the expansion fee. Not the operating cost, not the stadium bill, just the permission to play in MLS is $500 million. Suddenly you say, hey, I don't have $500 million, but I have $50 million and I have five friends who want to give me $50 million too. We'll go buy, you know, I don't know, El Paso Locomotive, build a soccer specific stadium, and then we're going to compete to get to Division One, and then suddenly my team, you know, can be evaluated. Because like, look at the evaluations of MLS compared to 2005. 20 years ago, they were worth 1/4 that they are now, and now there's I think the lowest team is worth $500 million. So like, there are ways here to count and understand the significance of this. I don't think that this will hurt. I don't think they would do this without like a parachute payment. You were talking about this earlier on the podcast to protect the owners that would be impacted by ProRail. But it's still 5 years from now to where like these ownership groups are either going to find partners to invest in, or they're going to try to like quietly exfiltrate and get out while the getting out is good. And that's all there is to it.
Yeah. And, as we move on here, Andrew is saying, thinking back to the preseason result here, how does the quality gap between the best and worst MLS teams compare to the best USL Championship and worst MLS teams? Then best and worst USL Championships, top of USL 1 versus bottom of USL Championship, etc.
I mean, we've spoken at great lengths in these 3 years we've been doing this podcast now that parity is something very special in the USL. It's also kind of feels hypocritical to say it in a year where Louisville ran with the table at like 73 points and Miami FC got 9. So does it still exist? Yeah. But I think if you can get away from the table, I think when you look at the actual impact of the talent, you know, MLS with that DP rule, it's such a game changer. You can have 3, and now with the 4 U22 initiative mechanics, plus the way you can stack TAM and GAM, you can have, like, we're always talking about how like the Yankees and now the Dodgers buy all the players and like dominate, you know, baseball, and NBA creates super teams to win. We thought that MLS as a single system, you know, closed thing, that like that couldn't exist, but now with all of the mechanics that exist, they can stack players. They can have a look at Inter Miami. There's no way, like Colorado Rapids, they have the money in their ownership group. They're not going to go out and spend that. I just read an article the other day that the Philadelphia Union have only spent in their lifetime something like $16 million on transfers and acquisitions.
That's amazing.
That's what like the Galaxy spend on 2 players. You know, so, you know, when you say the results, it's hard because not all teams have the same resources, but I think that you'd see a let's say a smaller gap between the best team in the USL Championship and the worst team in the USL Championship, whereas it is a like Mariana Trench of a chasm between the MLS teams. And then in terms of the USL One, I don't know enough to, I know it enough to be dangerous, but I don't know enough to compare it. And it's also hard to say because like over the last 2 years, 2 teams moved up. So North Carolina was almost relatively competitive and they did pretty good. Now, Sporting Lexington comes up, so we'll see how they do. They've been spending money, so they were both USL 1 teams the prior season. I think the Jägermeister Cup is going to show us what that kind of parity, what that skill offset looks like, but I would say that the USL is probably, at least the championship, is the best suited, minus some outliers on both sides, to say, like, if you're looking for, like, unpredictability, like, if you're a betting man, USL championship's probably the hardest one to figure out.
And so, in classic Andrew fashion, he couldn't wait for the answer and kind of got us an answer and sent it to us before. So I can go through some of it here. And so back when 538 was still
Did Andrew answer his own question?
Yeah.
Fantastic.
And so when they were still doing global club like soccer rankings, so the gap between the top of MLS to the bottom was 298 places. 146 being the top and 444 being the bottom. So the gap from the top USL Championship to the bottom was 147 places, 428 to 629. So worst MLS teams was only 38 places better than the best championship teams. So relatively close there. And year after year, they continue to improve. Maybe with MLS, you see the top kind of stretch out, but then you continue to have teams in MLS who are just like you said, Colorado, who are like, we could spend money, but also
that's relegation for you.
What if we didn't?
If you had relegation, you wouldn't but you know what though? It is interesting because you do every once in a while see these cycles. Like Philadelphia Union went on the run. They almost won the cup in 2022. San Jose seems to be tired. New England Revolution seemed to be tired of being losers. So they are now spiking their payrolls and like kind of cleaning out their closets. So it does happen to a certain extent, but it's not the same urgency, the same immediacy of like, hey, we're about to go down a division if we don't get our act together. So for good or for bad, USL is still the superior product in my mind. And I say this as a person who watches the MLS and will continue to do so. I love both teams, or leagues, but I think USL is just slightly more interesting.
Absolutely.
So I think next we have Shadow Wolf writes in, D1 teams obviously will have to spend more on their players. The bond owners have to put in, does the ownership have the money for it? I think he's specifically referring to RIFC here. What are your thoughts?
I would think so. I mean, we've already, from what we've seen, this team has been putting its money where its mouth is. And I think we're going to see, you know, a nice good influx of fans this next year with a brand new stadium. I think the hype will continue to grow around. We're still realistically talking about a champion or a premiership that's a few years out. So, you know, at this point, I don't really have anything to worry about in terms of the team staying competitive. I mean, are they going to be a team who's going to go out and splash tons of cash every single year? Maybe not, but I think there'll be a marquee signing to kind of, you know, make sure that the coach has the tools that he needs to kind of get the job done. It's kind of a give and take in the sense of if the coach is instilling enough trust in the ownership group to have them back him, I think they're going to go out and do it. And in the case where we have Kano right now, who took us to a final in the first year, like, you get the man what he wants. Maybe
well, MLS money could come knocking,
yeah,
and then that's
within reason, obviously. But maybe a few years down the line, you know, when Kano's are coaching, you know, some other team somewhere, as he's kind of earned his pay raise there, and maybe we're kind of on a, you know, striding new territory kind of thing. Sure, maybe you don't go out and break the bank until you kind of know what you got. But I would think that if they can see, all right, this is the real deal, we're in a good position. If we get you your one or two pieces, can you get us the success that we're looking for? Cool, then yeah, let's do it.
I would just add really quickly, Brett Johnson came into this with X amount of money. It came short when we suddenly got hit with all of the unsolicited events in the world, with whether it was supply chain, COVID, inflation, interest rates, all of that. He had to kind of go back to the well, and he as an individual is not, you know, infinite rich. He's just wealthy. So where Brett comes in, because remember, he also is a investment firm partner and founder as well, where Brett may not have the money, he can find the money. And Brett's a really good people person. Brett's a connector. So, and we discover new ownership individuals on the regular. So, yeah, if Brett suddenly, or if the current ownership group didn't have enough, they would go out and find a partner who wanted to invest so that they could continue to be successful. Brett's not interested in kind of doing anything halfway. And so I don't see that as an issue.
All right. And Jay here wants to know, can we get a parking update?
No, you can't.
You can't park here.
You cannot park right here. You know, we rehashed this a couple episodes ago. We'll tell you what we know. One, we know that there will be tailgating to a certain extent in a limited capacity. Don't know the number. We know that there are roughly 4,000 parking spots mapped in a certain vicinity around the stadium. We don't know that number yet. Or I should say, we don't know the radius that that's mapped out to, because we heard an earlier report that there were 10,000 spots in the adjacent,
like,
areas.
The greater area, yeah.
Maybe that's all of Pawtucket. I don't know that one per se. We know that they're tearing down the old electrical building to make room for additional parking for the staff and players and VIP. And then we know that the immediate parking lots that are going to be the closest to the stadium will be reserved for the VIP. I think we also know that right in front of the stadium, that will be reserved as kind of like a limited access, mostly designed for people to be able to walk around and like safely and quickly get to the stadium and cross that street. So we know those things for sure. What I will tell you, and anyone that is making way too much noise online, is that one, even though the home opener is less than 30 days away, or sorry, not the home opener, even though the first game
season, yeah,
is less than 30 days away, the home opener is almost 3 months away. And so there is plenty of time to get that information out to people. And if the argument is, well, last year at Burn, you know, they dropped the ball. Yes, Rhode Island FC could have handled the Burn parking situation a lot better because it was a controlled lot. It was in their power. They kind of knew, and then they waited. And maybe that was because they had already had to like have the setbacks of, hey, we're not going to get to play in our stadium because of a delay. We're making you come out all the way out here. Maybe it was them like getting you hooked with season tickets and going, hey, surprise, now you have to pay to park. I don't know any of that, but what I do know is that this isn't Burn, right? It's not everything's in their control. They're going to have to partner with the city planning. They're going to have to park with fire and police. They have to plan with the individuals that live in the area, from residential to business. This is a
massive undertaking,
very complicated scenario, and they're still trying to get the stadium done on time. So they have committed that a parking plan will come out. When it comes out, it may be 30 days before the stadium, you know, comes online. The point I want to make to any fan is that if you're worried about parking, they know, they hear you. They are not trying to upset or frustrate anyone, but you have to have an understanding of what they're trying. Like right now, they have to get the stadium online by 5-3. That's all that matters. I bet you they would rather have the stadium done and be available and then like not available to the public so they could just play the game legally and not have to reschedule from that perspective. And obviously they don't want to do that, but parking is coming. And I just ask people to be patient. You're not owed anything yet just because you have a ticket. They have the time. Stop. Don't harass the club for this information. They know how important it is. And if the only reason that you want to know is because you're trying to identify if you have to pay or not, my guess is that if you want to park anywhere close to the stadium, there will most likely be a requirement or an expectation to pay for it. I can especially say for like a tailgating lot, because they're going to have to put security and people to make sure that you're partying in a safe space, a safe way. So my guess is the closer you are to the stadium, there, especially if you're trying to like park in a parking lot, there's going to be a chance that you are going to have to pay. If you end up in someone's personal driveway at a home like two blocks down, you're going to pay for that. If you're not going to want to pay for parking, you're going to have to find a street somewhere that's a, you know, 10 to 15 minute walk away from the stadium, and then, you know, switch back your way, you know, cut through the streets and head down. But if you're just worried about the financial part, yes. No one should be surprised by this. Like, there's parking. You pay for parking just about anywhere in any major urban metropolitan area. You have to pay for parking in Pawtucket if you park in certain places already anyways. Like, free parking is a luxury that is not going to be probably afforded to a certain degree. Now, that doesn't mean it won't exist. You just may have to walk farther. So, like, what's valuable to you? Your time to get to the stadium in proximity, or, you know, an extra $5, $10, $15, $20 in your wallet? I don't have those details, but if that's the only reason you're upset that you haven't heard about it yet, give the club some grace, let them get through everything, and they will tell you in due time what that plan is. Did I miss anything there, Jason? I feel like there's just been so much noise created for no reason whatsoever.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think that there are just some expectations that we're just going to have to accept in terms of, this is a brand new year one, right? we're running it back. We're starting all over again. So there are going to be some growing pains. I think that they will identify some needs. Maybe eventually we'll see some additional parking as, you know, the seasons go on. Someone will build a parking garage or something for us. I don't know. But at this point, maybe just plan for parking options to be limited. Reach out to your friends. Carpool. I mean, soccer is a community sport. It's much better. It's much more fun hanging out, enjoying spending a time with friends. Make some sort of rituals, meet up, get together, ride share, bike, boat, you know, fly, walk, whatever you need to do.
Fly. I will say this. It was mentioned in the Discord earlier last week. For the people that are listening to this podcast, for the most part, I think that they're also the ones most connected to the club. This should not be make or break it for you.
Yeah, you're going to be there anyway. Right. Don't lie to yourself.
So right now, you need to think about this from the optics of like the casual or the interested party who's waiting for things. The more complaining you do online, the more negativity you put out in the world, the randoms or the people waiting to see this project fail, they jump on that.
Oh, those Facebook people, yeah.
And so there's no reason, if you love this club, to make this an issue. You know, there's just no reason. So I challenge you, be smart with your what matters to you in these greater moments. Will we get season ticket member benefits? Yes. Will we find out about parking? Yes. Will we know about the know before you goes around the stadium involvement and all of the things there? Absolutely. We will find out all of these things. You just have to give the club time, because if you keep harassing the club, you put them behind on the things they need to get done, and that doesn't help anybody. So I'm going to get off my soapbox there and move on. Taras writes in, what are your expectations for this season? What will make a successful season, and what would be a disappointment?
So I would like to see us go further in the Open Cup. I think that's important, at least getting past the first round. Winning, that's obviously challenging when you have MLS sides in it, but I would like them to put up a fight, so to say. Considering where we got last season, if we talk about regular season, like home playoff game, I think is something that would be important considering how well this team did. I think not getting that could be a disappointment depending on how far they go. And then we have the new Jägermeister Cup. So looking at our group, you know, I think that we should, you know, make it to those next knockout rounds.
Yeah.
I'd at least be there or about, as they say, in terms of like trying on all fronts to go as far as we can.
Yeah. And I would just add, for like a disappointment standpoint, is if we ever saw the team kind of collapse and stop trying, especially in front of the fans at Tidewater. I've never seen them do it. I think maybe even at the final, you could tell that they knew they weren't winning that game, but they still kept trying, especially the players that got subbed on. Like, they were fighting every minute.
Amos was, and even Paniotu,
yeah,
they were playing their hearts out.
I think the only games where I saw them kind of start to slip and like lose their desire to be on the field may have been the first Colorado Springs game, because the game started well for them and then it kind of got away from them.
It kind of got out of control there too.
But you could blame the altitude there. Like, there was a lot of factors. They were young still. I mean, it was before midseason. And then the early game against Phoenix Rising, like, that game kind of got out of control. There was a lot of frustration building up. But I would never say I saw them give up. So as long as I never see this team give up, that would be the only way I'd be disappointed, is that they didn't fight for the crest.
All right, and Brad wants to know here, can you tell us who is injured right now?
Yeah, so we don't know the extent of their recovery timelines or the extent of their injuries, but we do know that there are three players on the mend currently. Isaac Ankin coming off of the ACL recovery. We don't know his timeline, but the dude looks like he wants to start tomorrow. We know Jackson Lee is recovering from a lower body injury. He got injured like the day before the USL Cup final, so we know that he's still on the mend. And we haven't seen him in active games or active, like, full-on practice just yet. And then we do know that Ugo Bacharach, the new signing from Minnesota United, he's working through some recoveries. Don't know his timeline yet. We'll probably learn that probably in the week before the regular season kicks off for the club, when we get to ask coach again. So otherwise, the rest of the squad, you know, hopefully they remain healthy and they are healthy. So we hope that it continues that way. Nate Holloway writes in, which player do you think will get the 10 goals, 10 assists award for the season? Who's going to go and get that accolade, the double digit king?
So there are two players who I think would be capable of this. One would be the one and only golden playmaker from last season, Noah Fusan. You know, maybe he started to kind of pick up his goal scoring there towards the end of the year. I could see if he could continue that form into this next year, especially from there getting some assists up to JJ and Chico. That could definitely be something doable. And then the man of the hour himself, Maxi Rodriguez. I think that was a huge statement signing, and I think that that is something very capable from him as well.
I'm going to throw an outlier in there, a wild card, and it'll depend on the amount of contribution he gets to make, but I could see Isaac Ankin, if he comes back soon enough and has enough time. I mean, the guy got, I think, two goals and two assists in
like 37 seconds of playing, I think, yeah.
Yeah, and so, because remember, he came in late, I think, because he was injured, and I don't think he even played until May, and then he was out again before August, so, or like the first week of August. So he got, what, 8 games, and he got substituted for like 108 minutes, and he was able to be that productive. if we get him back, and I do not want to rush it, I would not want to rush him back for this to be earned, but if he came back before May and then he stayed healthy, he remained healthy for the season, and he got 15 minutes a game, I could absolutely see him getting, I'm not even joking. There's just something special about that kid. And then if I was to go on like a different tangent altogether, Joe Brito. I feel like Joe Brito could in some way, like sneakily, you know, I think he'd be hard pressed to get to the amount of goals, but I think he's got 10 assists in him. Maybe if it falls his way, Joe Brito could potentially be a 10 and 10 player.
Yeah. And then, so last one we got here, Stacy wants to know, what's been your favorite player or coach interaction since the club started?
I'm going to go coach, because Coach Cano and I have an ongoing rapport, we'll call it. But I've always appreciated that he treats me like media, but he also treats me as like part of the family at the same time. So like, you know, I think if he considered me like a through and through, and I don't want to ever call myself a journalist, I'm just using it for the example here. But if he treated me as a journalist, it'd be very transactional. What do you want to know? Here's my answer. And the more I like you, the more I'll answer. But the more I hate you, the like less you'll get from me, right? And I've seen him interact with other journos, right? With me, he always starts and finishes his interactions basically insulting me as a joke. and I'm not saying he's picking on me or anything. It's just like that's the rabble rousing. That's the camaraderie parts, right? Like, and some fans have seen it, right? At the block party, he insulted me. And like made some I forget what he said about me, but he made some joke at my expense in front of like 300 people that maybe 90 of them knew who I was. And then at the end, he gave me a compliment, like, you know, 4 minutes later into his, you know, speech about it. Same thing at the open practice where they invited all of the fans out. I was just sitting there just soaking it in, watching. I was just talking to fans. I was more interested in the fans because I usually have access to any practice I want to go to. And so people are just asking him questions, and some really good questions from the fans, by the way. And then I didn't say anything. I was just standing in the back. And then like, he just looks me straight in the eye, like, what, you're not going to talk to me? You don't have a question. And like all these people who just got to learn me, like they all look back and like, who is that? Why is he calling that guy? Why is he calling that redheaded goof out? And so like, I appreciate that. I will share though, my favorite moment of the year. Again, just more of like the interactions, the back and forth between Cano and I. It was right after we won at Lou. I'm on the pitch talking to the players, getting pictures, getting quotes and stuff. And I knew I wasn't going to get into the locker room. I don't have that level of authority. And so I'm trying to ask Cano some questions on the way, like as they're walking back. And I was like, the game, I think, for Charleston hadn't happened yet against Tampa. But if Tampa had won, we would get to host. That was going to be the priority. And so I said, hey, I have a question for you. You know, if the results stand, who would you rather play? Would you rather play Tampa or would you rather play Charleston? And he looked at me and he goes, are you kidding me? That's the dumbest question I've ever heard. And I said, no, I'm just asking because like, would it be a good sign of faith to go through the hardest teams to like battle forge this group? Matt, I want a home game. End of story. Like, what are you doing here? And like, and then, so the best part, I was like, listen, I don't ask great questions all the time. And he just kind of shook his head. And again, we're just smiling and laughing. And then I realized that he's mic'd up. And I go, wait. And Scott Beer, who's been doing the documentary following the club, he's like, yeah, I got that on tape. We'll be using that in the documentary. I was like, oh, man.
Oh, I'm going to look forward to that part.
So anyways, that's end scene there. That's my story. How about you? What interaction do you have? Because I know you don't remember the Blue Power Ranger hugging Coach Cano story. No, you were there, but you weren't there.
It was a fog. I mean, yeah, a lot of the, I do think that there are a lot of kind of fun scrums afterwards. In terms of like players, there was the one was like, what was that one other 4 p.m. game we had where they kind of let everyone out and just talk to the players? That was a lot of fun. And then one of our mutual friends was trying to like hit on some of the players' girlfriends, but obviously not in their league. That was amazing.
That friend is never coming to Tidewater.
Yeah, he wouldn't make it.
No, he'd be passed out in the stands. Too much trunk wine. Anyways, I think that's a great way to end it. So we're going to continue these series of questions. Feel free to write them in. We'll remind people on Thursdays if they have any pressing questions, but you can send us questions on our Instagram, our Twitter. You can DM us directly. We'll always respond. You can email us, raisinganchorpodcast@gmail.com. There's also a submission form on the website, raisinganchorpodcast.com. So there's many ways to get in touch. You can send a carrier pigeon if you know where the studio is, and we'll get that. But we always love answering these kinds of questions, so please feel free. No wrong questions, only wrong answers. Jason, you got anything else?
No, I guess I'll just take us away here. Thanks, everyone, for the questions. So make sure to check out our friends over at the Blazy Musket for all of your New England soccer coverage. That's including the RAFC at theblazymusket.com. You can follow us on Twitter, Threads, TikTok, and Blue Sky at RAFC Podcast. We've got an Instagram at Raising Anchor, and there's that good old website, raisinganchorpodcast.com.
Before you say anchors up, we have over 1,000 people on Instagram. We only have 200 on YouTube. So please, and also this video was recorded with one really good camera and one maybe not so good camera. It's working on that. It's a progress.
No, it's just the connection. I'll fix it for next week.
But please go and subscribe to the channel. It helps us out immensely. And if you're on TikTok, if you're on Twitter, X, or Blue Sky, just go give us a like, because it is wild to me now that we have like such a wild flux in one account and then less in the other one. So, get us out of here. Anchors up. Let's go.
Anchors up. Thanks, y'all. Catch you later.